and the gray pall upon his usually jovial face deadened the light-hearted atmosphere.
"We are in trouble,"
the halfling said grimly.
"Where's the orc?"
Bruno demanded as he pulled his axe from his belt, misunderstanding the halfling's meaning.
"In there. He's all right,"
Regis replied. The orc had been happy to tell its newfound friend everything about Akar Kessel's plans to invade 10 towns and the size of the gathering forces. Regis visibly trembled as he told his friends the news.
"All of the orc and goblin tribes and Verbi clans of this region of the spine of the world are banding together under a sorcerer named Akar Kessel,"
the halfling began. Drizzt and Wulfgar looked at each other, recognizing Kessel's name. The barbarian had thought Akar Kessel to be a huge frost giant when the Verbeek had spoken of him, but Drizzt had suspected differently, especially after the incident at the mirror.
"They plan to attack 10 towns,
Regis continued.
"And even the barbarians, led by some mighty one-eyed leader, have joined their ranks."
Wulfgar's face reddened in anger and embarrassment. His people fighting beside orcs. He knew the leader that Regis spoke of, for Wulfgar was of the tribe of the Elk, and had even once carried the tribe's standard as Hiefstag's herald. Drizzt painfully recalled the one-eyed king, too. He put a comforting hand on Wulfgar's shoulder. "Go to Bryn Shander," the drow told Brunner and Regis. "The people must prepare." Regis winced at the futility. If the orc's estimation of the assembling army had been correct, all of 10 towns joined together could not withstand the assault. The halfling dropped his head and mouthed silently, not wanting to alarm his friends any more than was necessary.
"We have to leave."
Though Brunner and Regis were able to convince Cassius of the urgency and importance of their news, it took several days to round up the other spokesmen for council. It was the height of knucklehead season, late summer, and the last push was on to land a big catch for the final trading caravan to Luskin. The spokesmen of the 9 fishing villages understood their responsibilities to their community, but they were reluctant to leave the lakes even for a single day. And so, with the exceptions of Cassius of Bryn Shander, Muldoon, the new spokesman from Lonelywood, who looked up to Regis as the hero of his town, Glen Sather of Easthaven, the community ever willing to join in for the good of 10 towns, and a Gorwell of Tourmaline, who held fierce loyalty to Brunner, the mood of the council was not very receptive. Kemp, still bearing a grudge against Brunner for the incident over Drizzt after the Battle of Bryn Shander, was especially disruptive. Before Cassius even had the opportunity to present the formalities of order, the gruff spokesman from Targos leaped up from his seat and slammed his fists down on the table.
"Damn the formal readings and be on with it," Kemp growled. "By what right do you order us in from the lakes, Cassius? Even as we sit around this table, the merchants in Luskin are preparing for their journey."
"We have news of an invasion, Spokesman Kemp,"
Cassius answered calmly, understanding the fisherman's anger.
"I would not have summoned you, any of you, at this time of the season, if it were not urgent."
"Then the rumors are true," Kemp sneered. "An invasion, you say? Bah, I see beyond this sham of a council."
He turned on a Gorwell. The fighting between Targos and Tourmaline had escalated in the past few 10 days, despite Cassius's efforts to defuse it and bring the principals of the warring towns to the bargaining table. A Gorwell had agreed to a meeting, but Kemp was steadfastly against it. And so, with suspicions running high, the timing of this urgent council could not have been worse.
"This is a pitiful attempt indeed," Kemp roared.
He looked around at his fellow spokesman.
"A pitiful effort by a Gorwell and his scheming supporters to bring about a favorable settlement for Tourmaline in their dispute with Targos."
Incited by the aura of suspicion that Kemp had infused, Shermont, the new spokesman from Caer Conic, pointed an accusing finger at Jensen Brent of Caer Denival.
"What part have you played in this treachery?"
he spat at his bitter rival. Shermont had come into his position after the first spokesman from Caer Conic had been killed on the waters of Lac Dinashir in a battle with a Denival boat. Doram Lugar had been Shermont's friend and leader, and the new spokesman's policies toward hated Cair Denival were even more iron-handed than those of his predecessor. Regis and Bruner sat back quietly in helpless dismay through all of the initial bickering. Finally, Cassius slammed his gavel down, snapping its handle in two and quieting the others long enough to make a point.
"A few moments of silence," he commanded. "Hold your venomous words and listen to the messenger of grim tidings."
The others fell back to their seats and remained silent, but Cassius feared that the damage had already been done. He turned the floor over to Regis. Honestly terrified by what he had learned from the captive orc, Regis passionately told of the battle his friends had won over the Verbeeg Lair and on the grass of Daledrop.
"And Bruner has captured one of the orcs that was escorting the giants," he said emphatically.
Some of the spokesmen sucked in their breath at the notion of such creatures banding together, but Kemp and some of the others, ever suspicious of the more immediate threats of their rivals and already decided on the true purpose of the meeting, remained unconvinced.
"The orc told us," Regis continued grimly, "of the coming of a powerful wizard, Akar Kessel, and his vast host of goblins and giants. They mean to conquer 10 towns.
He thought that his dramatics would prove effective. But Kemp was outraged.
"On the word of an orc, Cassius? You summoned us in from the lakes at this critical time on the threat of a stinking orc?"
"The halfling's tale is not an uncommon one," Shermont added. "All of us have heard a captured goblin wag its tongue in any direction it could think of to save its worthless head.
Or perhaps you had other motives,"
Kemp hissed, again eyeing a Gorwul. Cassius, though he truly believed the grim tidings, sat back in his chair and said nothing. With tensions on the lakes as high as they were, and the final trading fair of a particularly fruitless fishing season fast approaching, he had suspected that this would occur. He looked resignedly at Bruner and Regis, and shrugged as once again the council degenerated into a shouting match. Amidst the ensuing commotion, Regis slipped the ruby pendant out from under his waistcoat and nudged Bruner. They looked at it and each other in disappointment. They had hoped that the magical gem wouldn't be needed. Regis pounded his gavel in a call for the floor and was granted it by Cassius. Then, as he had done 5 years previous, he hopped up on the table and walked toward his chief antagonist. But this time the result wasn't what Regis had expected. Kemp had spent many hours over the last 5 years reflecting on that council before the barbarian invasion. The spokesman was glad of the final outcome of that whole situation, and in truth, realized that he and all of 10 towns were indebted to the halfling for making them heed his warning. Yet it bothered Kemp more than a little that his initial stance had been so easily swayed. He was a brawling type whose first love, even above fishing, was battle, but his mind was keen and always alert to danger. He had observed Regis several times over the last few years and had listened intently to tales of the halfling's prowess in the art of persuasion. As Regis approached, the burly spokesman averted his eyes.
"Begone, trickster!"
he growled, shoving his chair defensively back from the table.
"You seem to have a strange way of convincing people of your point of view, but I'll not fall under your spell this time," he addressed the other spokesman. "Where the halfling, he has some magic about him, be sure."
Kemp understood that he would have no way of proving his claims, but he also realized that he wouldn't have to. Regis looked about, flustered, and unable to even answer the spokesman's accusations. Even a Gorwul, though the spokesman from Tourmaline tactfully tried to hide the fact, would no longer look Regis straight in the eye.
"Sit down, trickster," Kemp taunted. "Your magic's no good once we're on to you."
Bruner, silent up to now, suddenly leaped up, his face contorted with rage.
"Is this too a trick, dog of Targos?"
the dwarf challenged. He pulled a sack from his belt and rolled its contents, a severed Verbeeg head, down the table toward Kemp. Several of the spokesmen jumped back in horror, but Kemp remained unshaken.
"We have dealt with rogue giants many times before," the spokesman replied coolly. "Rogues?"
Bruner echoed incredulously.
2 score of the beasts we cut down, orcs and ogres besides. A passing band, Kemp explained evenly, stubbornly. And all dead, so you have said. Why then does this become a matter for the council? If it is accolades you desire, mighty dwarf, then you shall have them.
His voice dripped with venom, and he watched Brunner's reddening face with deep pleasure.
Perhaps Cassius could make a speech in your honor before all of the people of Ten Towns.
Brunner slammed his fists onto the table, eyeing all of the men about him in an open threat to anyone who would continue Kemp's insults.
We have come before ye to help ye save your homes and your kin, he roared. Might be that ye believe us, and ye'll do something to survive. Or might be that ye'll hear the words of the Dog of Targos, and ye'll do nothing. Either way, I've had enough of ye. Do as ye will, and may your gods show ye favor.
He turned and stalked out of the room. Brunner's grim tone brought many of the spokesmen to realize that the threat was simply too grave to be passed off as the deception of a desperate captive, or even as a more insidious plan by Cassius and some conspirators. Yet Kemp, proud and arrogant, and certain that Agorwal and his non-human friends, the halfling and the dwarf, were using the facade of an invasion to gain some advantage over the superior city of Targos, would not budge. Second only to Cassius in all of Ten Towns, Kemp's opinion carried great weight, especially to the people of Caer Conig and Caer Dinneval, who, in light of Bryn Shander's unshakable neutrality in their struggle, sought the favor of Targos. Enough spokesmen remained suspicious of their rivals and were willing to accept Kemp's explanation to prevent Cassius from bringing the council to decisive action. The lines were soon clearly drawn. Regis watched the spectacle as the opposing sides volleyed back and forth, but the halfling's own credibility had been destroyed, and he had no impact on the rest of the meeting. In the end, little was decided. The most that Agorwal, Glensather, and Muldoon could squeeze out of Cassius was a public declaration that a general warning should go out to every household in Ten Towns. Let the people know of our grim tidings, and let them be assured that I shall make room within the walls of Bryn Shander for every person who so desires our protection. Regis eyed the divided spokesman. Without unity, the halfling wondered how much protection even the high walls of Bryn Shander could offer.
20. A slave to no man.
No arguing! Brunner snarled.
Though none of his 4 friends standing beside him on the rocky slopes of the climb had any intention of speaking against the decision. In their foolish pettiness and pride, the majority of the spokesmen had doomed their communities to almost certain destruction, and neither Drizzt, Wulfgar, Catti Bree, nor Regis expected the dwarves to join in such a hopeless cause.
When will you block the mines? Drizzt asked.
The drow hadn't yet decided if he would join the dwarves in the self-imposed prison of their caves, but he had planned to act as scout to Bryn Shander, at least until Akar Kessel's army moved into the region.
The preparing'll begin tonight, said Brunner. But once they're in place, we've no rush. We'll let the stinking orcs come right down our throats afore we drop the tunnels, and take 'em in the fall. Are ye to stay with us then?
Drizzt shrugged his shoulders. Though he was still shunned by most of the people of Ten Towns, the drow felt a strong sense of loyalty and wasn't sure that he could turn his back on his chosen home, even under suicidal circumstances. And Drizzt had little desire to return to the lightless underworld, even in the hospitable caverns of the dwarven town.
And what's your decision? Brunner asked Regis.
The halfling, too, was torn between his instincts for survival and his loyalty to Ten Towns. With the help of the ruby, he had lived well during the last years on Mare Dualden. But now his cover had been stripped away. After the rumors flowing out of the council, everyone in Bryn Shander whispered about the halfling's magical influence. It wouldn't be long before all of the communities heard about Kemp's accusations and avoided, if not openly shunned him. Either way, Regis knew that his days of easy living in Lonelywood were nearing an end.
Thank you for the invitation, he said to Brunner. I'll come in before Kessel arrives.
Good, replied the dwarf. You'll get a room near the boy, so none of the dwarves has to hear your belly aching.
He flashed Drizzt a good-natured wink.
Nay, said Wulfgar.
Brunner looked at him curiously, misunderstanding the barbarian's intentions, and wondering why he objected to having Regis beside him.
Watch yourself, boy, the dwarf teased. If you're thinking you're to be staying beside the girl, then be thinking about ducking your head from the swing of the axe.
Catty Bree chuckled softly, embarrassed yet truly touched.
Your minds are not the place for me, Wulfgar said suddenly. My life is on the plain.
Ye forget that your life is mine for choosing, Brunner retorted.
In truth, his yelling was more the short temper of a father than the outrage of a master. Wulfgar rose before the dwarf, proud and stern. Drizzt understood and was pleased. Now Brunner also had an idea of what the barbarian was getting at, and though he hated the thought of separation, he felt more pride in the boy at that moment than ever before.
My time of indenture is not ended, Wulfgar began. Yet I have repaid my debt to you, my friend, and to your people many times over. I am Wulfgar, he proudly proclaimed, his jaw firm and his muscles tightened with tension. No more a boy, but a man, a free man.
Brunner felt the moisture rimming his eyes. For the first time, he did nothing to conceal it. He walked out before the huge barbarian and returned Wulfgar's unyielding stare with a look of sincere admiration.
So ye are, Brunner observed. Then might I ask ye, on your choice, if you'll stay and fight beside me?
Wulfgar shook his head.
My debt to you is paid in truth, and forever I shall name you as my friend. Dear friend. But I have another debt yet to pay.
He looked out to Kelvin's cairn and beyond. The countless stars shone clearly over the tundra, making the open plain seem even more vast and empty.
Out there, in another world.
Catty Bree sighed and shuffled uncomfortably. She alone fully understood the vague picture that Wulfgar was painting, and she wasn't pleased with his choice. Brunner nodded, respecting the barbarian's decision.
Go then, and live well,
he said, straining to hold his breaking voice even as he moved to the rocky trail. He paused for one last moment and looked back at the tall young barbarian.
You're a man. There's none to argue that, he said over his shoulder. But don't ye never forget that ever ye'll be me boy.
I shan't,
Wulfgar whispered softly as Brunner disappeared into the tunnel. He felt Drizzt's hand on his shoulder.
When do you leave? The drow asked. Tonight, Wulfgar replied. These grim days offer no leisure.
And where do you go?
Catty Bree asked, already knowing the truth and also the vague answer that Wulfgar would give. The barbarian turned his misty gaze back out to the plain.
Home.
He started back down the trail, Regis following. But Catty Bree waited behind and motioned for Drizzt to do likewise.
Say your farewells to Wulfgar this night, she told the drow. I do not believe that he shall ever return.
Home is a place for him to choose, Drizzt replied, guessing that the news about Hiefstag's joining Kessel had played a part in Wulfgar's decision. He watched the departing barbarian with respect. He has some private matters to attend to.
More than you know,
Catty Bree said. Drizzt looked at her curiously.
Wulfgar has an adventure in mind, she explained.
She hadn't meant to break her trust with Wulfgar, but figured that Drizzt O'Erden, above anyone else, might be able to find a way to help.
One that I believe has been put upon him before he is ready.
Matters of the tribes are his own business, Drizzt said, guessing what the girl was suggesting. The barbarians have their own ways and do not welcome outsiders.
Of the tribes I agree, said Catti Bree. Yet Wolfgar's path, unless I am mistaken, does not lead directly home. He has something else ahead of him, an adventure that he has often hinted at but never fully explained. I only know that it involves great danger, and a vow that even he fears is above his ability to fulfill alone.
Drizzt looked over the starry plain and considered the girl's words. He knew Catti Bree to be shrewd and observant beyond her years. He did not doubt her guesses. The stars twinkled above the cool night, the celestial dome engulfing the flat rim of the horizon, a horizon as yet unmarked by the fires of an advancing army, Drizzt noted.
Perhaps he had time.
Although Cassius's proclamation reached even the most remote of the towns within 2 days, few groups of refugees came down the roads to Bryn Shander. Cassius had fully expected this, or he never would have made the bold offer of sheltering all who would come. Bryn Shander was a fair-sized city, and her present population was not as large as it had once been. There were many vacant buildings within the walls, and an entire section of the city, reserved for visiting merchant caravans, lay empty at the present time. However, if even half of the people of the other 9 communities sought refuge, Cassius would be hard-pressed to honor his pledge. The spokesman wasn't worried. The people of 10 towns were a hardy folk and lived under the threat of a goblin invasion every day. Cassius knew that it would take more than an abstract warning to make them leave their homes, and with the allegiance between the towns at such a low point, few of the town leaders would take any action at all to convince their people to flee. As it turned out, Glensathar and Agorwal were the only spokesmen to arrive at the gates of Bryn Shander. Nearly all of Easthaven stood behind their leader, but Agorwal had less than half of the people of Tourmaline behind him. The rumors from the arrogant city of Targos, itself nearly as well defended as Bryn Shander, made it clear that none of its people would leave. Many of Tourmaline's fishermen, fearing the economic advantage that Targos would gain over them, had refused to give up the most lucrative month of the fishing season. Such was also the case with Caer Conig and Caer Dinaval. Neither of the bitter enemies dared give any edge to the other, and not a single person from either city fled to Bryn Shander. To the people of these embattled communities, the orcs were but a distant threat that would have to be dealt with if it ever materialized. But the fighting with their immediate neighbors was brutally real and evident in all their daily routines. On the western outskirts, the town of Bremen remained fiercely independent of the other communities, viewing Cassius's offer as a feeble attempt by Bryn Shander to reaffirm its position of leadership. Goodmead and Dugan's Hole in the south had no intention of hiding in the walled city or of sending any troops to aid in the fighting. These 2 towns on Redwaters, smallest of the lakes and poorest in terms of knuckleheads, could not afford any time away from the boats. They had heeded the call for unity 5 years previous under the threat of a barbarian invasion, and though they had suffered the worst losses of all the towns in the battle, they had gained the least. Several groups filtered in from Lonelywood, but many of the folk of the northernmost town preferred to stay out of the way. Their hero had lost face, and even Muldoon now viewed the halfling in a different light and passed the warning of invasion off as a misunderstanding, or perhaps even a calculated hoax. The greater good of the region had fallen beneath the lesser personal gains of stubborn pride, with most of the people of 10 towns confusing unity with dependence. Regis returned to Bryn Shander to make some personal arrangements on the morning after Wolfgar departed. He had a friend coming from Lonelywood with his prized belongings, so he remained in the city, watching in dismay as the days drifted by without any real preparations being made to meet the coming army. Even after the council, the halfling had held out some hope that the people would realize the impending doom and band together. But now he came to believe that the dwarves' decision to abandon Ten Towns and lock themselves into their mines was the only option they had if they wished to survive. Regis partially blamed himself for the coming tragedy, convinced that he had gotten careless. When he and Drizzt had concocted plans to use political situations and the power of the ruby to force the towns into unity against the barbarians, they had spent many hours predicting the initial responses of the spokesman and weighing the worth of each town's alliance. This time, though, Regis had placed more faith in the people of Ten Towns and in the stone, figuring that he could simply employ its power to sway any of the few remaining doubters of the severity of the situation. Yet Regis could not sustain his own guilt as he heard the arrogant and mistrusting responses coming in from the towns. Why should he have to trick the people into defending themselves? If they were stupid enough to let their own pride bring about their destruction, then what responsibility or even what right did he have to rescue them?
"You get what you deserve,"
the halfling said aloud, smiling in spite of himself when he realized that he was beginning to sound as cynical as Brunner. But callousness was his only protection against such a helpless situation. He hoped that his friend from Lonelywood would arrive soon. His sanctuary lay underground. Akkar Kessel sat on the crystal throne in the Hall of Scrying, the third level of Kryshal Tirith, his fingers tapping nervously on the arm of the great chair as he stared intently at the dark mirror before him. Bigrin was long overdue with a report on the reinforcement caravan. The last summons the wizard had received from the lair had been suspicious, with no one on the other end to greet his reply. Now the mirror in the lair revealed only blackness, resisting all of the wizard's attempts to scry out the room. If the mirror had been broken, Kessel would have been able to sense the shift in his visions. But this was more mysterious, for something he could not understand was blocking his distant sight. The dilemma unnerved him, made him think that he had been deceived or discovered. His fingers continued to rap nervously.
"Perhaps it is time to make a decision,"
Ertu, in its customary place at the side of the wizard's throne, suggested.
"We have not yet reached our fullest strength," Kessel retorted. "Many goblin tribes and a large clan of giants have not come in, and the barbarians are not yet ready." "The troops thirst for battle," Ertu pointed out. "They fight with each other. You may find that your army will soon fall apart around you."
Kessel agreed that holding so many goblin tribes together for long was a risky and dangerous proposition. Perhaps it would be better if they marched at once. But still, the wizard wanted to be certain. He wanted his forces at their strongest.
"Where is Bigrin?" Kessel wailed. "Why hasn't he answered my summons?" "What preparations are the humans now making?" Ertu asked abruptly.
But Kessel was not listening. He rubbed the sweat from his face. Maybe the shard and the demon had been right about sending the less conspicuous barbarians to the lair. What must the fishermen be thinking if they had found such an unusual combination of monsters lairing in their area? How much had they guessed? Ertu noted Kessel's discomfort with grim satisfaction. The demon and the shard had been pushing Kessel to strike much earlier, as soon as Bigrin's messages had stopped coming in, but the cowardly wizard, needing more assurance that his numbers were overwhelming, had continued to delay.
"Shall I go to the troops?"
Ertu asked, confident that Kessel's resistance was gone.
"Send runners to the barbarians and to the tribes that have not yet joined us," Kessel instructed. "Tell them that to fight beside us is to join in the feast of victory, but those who do not fight beside us shall fall before us. Tomorrow we march."
Ertu rushed from the tower without delay, and soon cheers for the onset of war echoed throughout the huge encampment. Goblins and giants raced excitedly about, breaking down tents and packing supplies. They had anticipated this moment for long 10 days, and now they wasted no time in making the final preparations. That same night, The vast army of Akkar Kessel pulled up its camp and began its long march toward Ten Towns. Back in the routed Verbeeg lair, the scrying mirror sat unmoved and unbroken, securely covered by the heavy blanket that Driz Doerden had thrown over it. Epilogue. He ran under the bright sun of day. He ran under the dim stars of the night, ever with the east wind in his face. His long legs and great strides carried him tirelessly, a mere speck of movement in the empty plain. For days, Wulfgar pushed himself to the absolute limits of his endurance, even hunting and eating on the run, stopping only when exhaustion felled him in his tracks. Far to the south of him, rolling out of the spine of the world like a toxic cloud of foul-smelling vapors, came the goblin and giant forces of Akkar Kessel. With minds warped by the willpower of the crystal shard, they wanted only to kill, only to destroy, only to please Akkar Kessel. 3 days out from the Dwarven Valley, the barbarian came across the jumbled tracks of many warriors, all leading toward a common destination. He was glad that he was able to find his people so easily, but the presence of so many tracks told him that the tribes were gathering, a fact that only emphasized the urgency of his mission. Spurred by necessity, he charged onward. It wasn't fatigue but solitude that was Wulfgar's greatest enemy. He fought hard to keep his thoughts on the past during the long hours, recalling his vow to his dead father and contemplating the possibilities of his victories. He avoided any thought of his present path, though, understanding well that the sheer desperation of his plan might well destroy his resolve. Yet this was his only chance. He was not of noble blood, and he had no rights of challenge against Tiefstag. Even if he defeated the chosen king, none of his people would recognize him as their leader. The only way that one such as he could legitimize a claim to tribal kingship was through an act of heroic proportions. He bounded on toward the same goal that had lured many would-be kings before him to their deaths. And in the shadows behind him, cruising with the graceful ease that marked his race, came Drizzt Do'Urden. Ever eastward, toward the Reghead Glacier and a place called Evermelt, toward the lair of Ingalakis Timitzilian, the white dragon the barbarians simply called Icing Death. Part 3. Kryshel Tirith. What does Wulfgar see when he looks out over the tundra? When his crystal blue eyes stare across the dark plain to the points of light that mark the fires of his people's encampment? Does he view the past, perhaps, with a longing to return to that place and those ways? Does he view the present, comparing that which he has learned with me and Brunner, with those harsh lessons of life among his nomadic tribesmen? Or does Wulfgar see the future, the potential for change, for bringing new and better ways to his people? A bit of all three, I would guess. That is the turmoil within Wulfgar, I suspect, the simmering fire behind those blue eyes. He fights with such passion. Some of that comes from his upbringing among the fierce tribesmen, the war games of the barbarian boys, often bloody, sometimes even fatal. Part of that passion for battle stems from Wulfgar's inner turmoil, the frustration he must feel when he contrasts his lessons at my hands and at Brunner's hands with those gained in his years among his own people. Wulfgar's people invaded Ten Towns, entered with merciless rage, ready to slaughter anyone who stood in their path without regard. How does Wulfgar reconcile that truth with the fact that Brunner Battlehammer did not let him die on the field, that the dwarf saved him, though he tried to kill Brunner in battle, though the foolish young lad made the mistake of swatting Brunner on the head? How does Wulfgar reconcile the love Brunner has shown him against his previous notions of dwarves as hateful, merciless enemies? for that is how the barbarians of Icewind Dale surely view dwarves, a lie that they perpetuate among themselves so they may justify their murderous raiding ways. It is not so different than the lies that the drow tell themselves to justify their hatred of anyone who is not drow. But now Wulfgar has been faced with the truth of Brunner and the dwarves, irrevocably. He must weigh that personal revelation against every truth he spent his years of childhood learning. He must come to accept that what his parents and all the elders of the tribe told to him were lies. I know from personal experience that this is no easy thing to reconcile. For to do so is to admit that a great part of your own life was no more than a lie, that a great part of that which makes you who you are is wrong. I recognized the ills of Menzo Berenzon early on, because its teachings went against logic and went against that which was in my heart. Yet even though those wrongs were painfully obvious, those first steps that carried me out of my homeland were not easy ones. The errors of the barbarians of Icewind Dale pale compared to those of the drow. And so, the steps that Wulfgar must take emotionally away from his people will be even more difficult, I fear. There is far more truth in the ways of the barbarians, more justification for their actions, warlike though they may be. Yet it falls upon Wulfgar's strong but painfully young shoulders to differentiate between the ways of his people and those of his new friends, to accept compassion and acceptance above the solid walls of prejudice that have so encapsulated his entire youth. I do not envy him the task before him, the confusion, the frustration. It is good that he fights every day. I only pray that in a blind fit while playing out that frustration, my sparring companion does not tear the head from my shoulders. Drizzt Do'Urden. 21. The Icy Tomb. At the base of the great glacier, hidden off in a small dell where one of the ice spurs wound through broken rifts and boulders, was a place the barbarians called Evermelt. A hot spring fed a small pool, the warmed waters waging a relentless battle against ice flows and freezing temperatures. Tribesmen stranded inland by early snows, who could not find their way to the sea with the reindeer herd, often sought refuge at Evermelt, for even in the coldest months of winter, unfrozen, sustaining water could be found here, and the warming vapors of the pool made the temperatures of the immediate area bearable, if not comfortable. Yet the warmth and drinking water were only a part of Evermelt's worth. Beneath the opaque surface of the misty water lay a hoard of gems and jewels, gold and silver, that rivaled the treasure of any king in this entire region of the world. Every barbarian had heard of the legend of the White Dragon, but most considered it to be just a fanciful tale recounted by self-important old men for the amusement of children. For the dragon hadn't emerged from its hidden lair in many, many years. Wulfgar knew better, though. In his youth, his father had accidentally stumbled upon the entrance to the secret cave. When Beornigar later learned the legend of the dragon, he understood the potential value of his discovery and had spent years collecting all of the information he could find concerning dragons, especially white dragons, and Ingalaca's Timitzilian in particular. Beornigar had been killed in a battle between tribes before he could make his attempt at the treasure, but living in a land where death was a common visitor, he had foreseen that grim possibility and had imparted his knowledge to his son. The secret did not die with him. Wulfgar felled a deer with a throw of Aegis Fang and carried the beast the last few miles to Evermelt. He had been to this place twice before, but when he came upon it now, as always, its strange beauty stole his breath. The air above the pool was veiled in steam, and chunks of floating ice drifted through the misty waters like meandering ghost ships. The huge boulders surrounding the area were especially colorful, with varying hues of red and orange, and they were encapsulated in a thin layer of ice that caught the fire of the sun and reflected brilliant bursts of sparkling colors in startling contrast to the dull gray of the misted glacier ice. This was a silent place, sheltered from the mournful cry of the wind by walls of ice and rock, free of any distractions. After his father was killed, Wulfgar had vowed, in tribute to the man, to make this journey and fulfill his father's dream. Now he approached the pool reverently, and though other matters pressed in on him, he paused for reflection. Warriors of every tribe on the tundra had come to Evermelt with the same hopes as he. None had ever returned. The young barbarian resolved to change that. He firmed his proud jaw and set to work skinning the deer. The first barrier that he had to overcome was the pool itself. Beneath its surface, the waters were deceptively warm and comfortable, but anyone who emerged from the pool into the air would be frozen dead in minutes. Wulfgar peeled away the hide of the animal and began scraping away the underlying layer of fat. He melted this over a small fire until it attained the consistency of thick paint, then smeared it over every inch of his body. Taking a deep breath to steady himself and focus his thoughts on the task at hand, he took hold of Aegis Fang and waded into Evermelt. Under the deadening veil of mist, the waters appeared serene. But as soon as he moved away from the edges of the pool, Wulfgar could feel the strong, swirling currents of the hot stream. Using a jutting rock overhang as a guidepost, he approximated the exact center of the pool. Once there, he took a final breath and, confident of his father's instructions, opened himself to the currents and let himself sink into the water. He descended for a moment, then was suddenly swept away by the main flow of the stream toward the north end of the pool. Even beneath the mist, the water was cloudy, forcing Wulfgar to trust blindly that he would break free of the water before his breath ran out. He was within a few feet of the ice wall at the pool's edge before he could see the danger. He braced himself for the collision, but the current suddenly swirled, sending him deeper. The dimness darkened to blackness as he entered a hidden opening under the ice, barely wide enough for him to slip through, though the unceasing flow of the stream gave him no choice. His lungs cried for air. He bit down on his lip to keep his mouth from bursting open and robbing him of the last wisps of precious oxygen. Then he broke into a wider tunnel where the water flattened out and dropped below the level of his head. He hungrily gasped in air, but he was still sliding along helplessly in the rushing water. One danger was past. The slide twisted and turned, and the roar of a waterfall clearly sounded up ahead. Wulfgar tried to slow his ride, but couldn't find a handhold or any kind of a brace, for the floor and walls were of ice smoothed under centuries of the flowing stream. The barbarian tossed wildly, Aegis Fang flying from his hands as he futilely tried to drive them into the solid ice. Then he came into a wide and deep cavern and saw the drop before him. A few feet beyond the crest of the fall were several huge icicles that stretched from the domed ceiling down below Wulfgar's line of sight. He saw his only chance. When he approached the lip of the drop, he sprang outward, wrapping his arms around an icicle. He dropped quickly as it tapered, but saw that it widened again as it neared the floor, as though a second icicle had grown up from the floor to meet this one. Safe for a moment, he gazed around the strange cavern in awe. The waterfall captured his imagination. Steam rose from the chasm, adding surrealistic flavor to the spectacle. The stream poured over the drop, most of it continuing on its way through a small chasm, barely a crack in the floor 30 feet below at the base of the fall. The droplets that cleared the chasm, though, solidified as they separated from the main flow of the stream and bounced away in all directions as they hit the cavern's ice floor. Not yet completely hardened, the cubes stuck fast where they landed, and all about the base of the waterfall were strangely sculpted piles of broken ice. Aegis Fang flew over the drop, easily clearing the small chasm to smash into one such sculpture, scattering shards of ice. Though his arms were numbed from the icicle slide, Wulfgar quickly rushed over to the hammer, already freezing fast where it had landed, and heaved it free of the ice's hardening grip. Under the glassy floor where the hammer had cracked away the top layers, the barbarian noticed a dark shadow. He examined it more closely, then backed away from the grisly sight. Perfectly preserved, one of his predecessors had apparently gone over the long drop, dying in the deepening ice where he had landed. How many others, Wulfgar wondered, had met this same fate? He didn't have time to contemplate it further. One of his other concerns had been dispelled, for much of the cavern's roof was only a few feet below the daylit surface, and the sun found its way in through those parts that were purely ice. Even the smallest glow coming from the ceiling was reflected 1,000 times on the glassy floors and walls, and the whole cavern virtually exploded in sparkling bursts of light. Wulfgar felt the cold acutely, but the melted fat had protected him sufficiently. He would survive the first dangers of this adventure. But the specter of the dragon loomed somewhere up ahead. Several twisting tunnels led off of the main chamber, carved by the stream in long past days when its waters ran high. Only one of these was large enough for a dragon, though. Wulfgar contemplated searching out the others first to see if he might possibly find a less obvious way into the lair. But the glare and distortions of light and the countless icicles hanging from the ceiling like a predator's teeth dizzied him, and he knew that if he got lost or wasted too much time, the night would fall over him, stealing his light and dropping the temperature below even his considerable tolerance. So he banged Aegis Fang on the floor to clear away any remaining ice that clung to it, and started straight ahead down the tunnel he believed would lead him to the lair of Ingalakis Timitzilian. The dragon slept soundly beside its treasure in the largest chamber of the ice caves, confident, after many years of solitude, that it would not be disturbed. Ingalakis Timitzilian, more commonly known as Icing Death, had made the same mistake that many of its kin, with their lairs in similar caves of ice, had made. The flowing stream that offered entrance to and escape from the caves had diminished over the years, leaving the dragon trapped in a crystalline tomb. Icing Death had enjoyed its years of hunting deer and humans. In the short time the beast had been active, it had earned quite a respectable reputation for havoc and terror. Yet dragons, especially white ones, who are rarely active in their cold environments, can live many centuries without meat. Their selfish love of their treasure can sustain them indefinitely, and Icing Death's hoard, though small compared to the vast mounds of gold collected by the huge reds and blues that lived in more populated areas, was the largest of any of the tundra-dwelling dragons. If the dragon had truly desired freedom, it could probably have broken through the cavern's ice ceiling. But Icing Death considered the risk too great, and so it slept, counting its coins and gems in dreams that dragons considered quite pleasant. The slumbering worm didn't fully realize, though, just how careless it had become. In its unbroken snooze, Icing Death hadn't moved in decades. A cold blanket of ice had crept over the long form, gradually thickening until the only clear spot was a hole in front of the great nostrils, where the rhythmic blasts of exhaled snores had kept the frost away. And so Wulfgar, cautiously stalking the source of the resounding snores, came upon the beast. Viewing Icing Death's splendor, enhanced by the crystalline ice blanket, Wulfgar looked upon the dragon with profound awe. Piles of gems and gold lay all about the cavern under similar blankets, but Wulfgar could not pull his eyes away. Never had he viewed such magnificence, such strength. Confident that the beast was helplessly pinned, he dropped the hammer's head down by his side.
"Greetings, Ingalakis Timitzilian," he called, respectfully using the beast's full name.
The pale blue orbs snapped open, their seething flames immediately apparent even under their icy veil. Wulfgar stopped short at their piercing glare. After the initial shock, he regained his confidence.
"Fear not, mighty worm," he said boldly. "I am a warrior of honor, and shall not kill you under these unfair circumstances." He smiled wryly. "My lust shall be appeased by simply taking your treasure."
But the barbarian had made a critical mistake. A more experienced fighter, even a knight of honor, would have looked beyond his chivalrous code, accepted his good fortune as a blessing, and slain the worm as it slept. Few adventurers, even whole parties of adventurers, had ever given an evil dragon of any color such a chance and lived to boast of it. Even Isengdeath, in the initial shock of its predicament, had thought itself helpless when it had first awakened to face the barbarian. The great muscles, atrophied from inactivity, could not resist the weight and grip of the ice prison. But when Wulfgar mentioned the treasure, a new surge of energy blew away the dragon's lethargy. Isengdeath found strength in anger, and with an explosion of power beyond anything the barbarian had ever imagined, the dragon flexed its cord-like muscles, sending great chunks of ice flying away. The entire cavern complex trembled violently, and Wulfgar, standing on the slippery floor, was thrown down on his back. He rolled aside at the very last moment to dodge the spear-like tip of a falling icicle dislodged by the tremor. Wulfgar regained his feet quickly, but when he turned, he found himself facing a horned white head leveled to meet his eyes. The dragon's great wings stretched outward, shaking off the last remnants of its blanket, and the blue eyes bore into Wulfgar. The barbarian desperately looked around for an escape. He pondered throwing Aegis Fang, but knew that he couldn't possibly kill the monster with a single strike, and inevitably the killing breath would come. Isengdeath considered its foe for a moment. If it breathed, it would have to settle for frozen flesh. It was a dragon, after all, a terrible worm, and it believed, probably rightly so, that no single human could ever defeat it. This huge man, however, and particularly the magical hammer, for the dragon could sense its might, disturbed the worm. Caution had kept Isengdeath alive through many centuries. It would not close to melee with this man. The cold air gathered in its lungs. Wulfgar heard the intake of air and reflexively dived to the side. He couldn't fully escape the blast that followed, a frosting cone of unspeakable cold, but his agility, combined with the deer fat, kept him alive. He landed behind a block of ice, his legs actually burned by the cold and his lungs aching. He needed a moment to recover, but he saw the white head lifting slowly into the air, taking away the angle of the meager barrier. The barbarian could not survive a second breath. Suddenly, a globe of darkness engulfed the dragon's head, and a black-shafted arrow, and then another, whirred by the barbarian and thudded unseen behind the blackness. "Attack, boy, now!" cried Drizdo Erden from the entrance to the chamber. The disciplined barbarian instinctively obeyed his teacher. Grimacing through the pain, he moved around the ice block and closed in on the thrashing worm. Isengdeath swung its great head to and fro, trying to shake free of the dark elf's spell. Hate consumed the beast as yet another stinging arrow found its mark. The dragon's only desire was to kill. Even blinded, its senses were superior. It marked out the drow's direction easily and breathed again. But Drizzt was well versed in dragon lore. He had gauged his distance from Isengdeath perfectly, and the strength of the deadly frost fell short. The barbarian charged in on the distracted dragon's side and slammed Aegis Fang with all of his great might against the white scales. The dragon winced in agony. The scales held under the blow, but the dragon had never felt such strength from a human and didn't care to test its hide against a second strike. It turned to release a third blast of breath on the exposed barbarian. But another arrow cracked home. Wulfgar saw a great gob of dragon blood splatter on the floor beside him, and he watched the globe of darkness lurch away. The dragon roared in anger. Aegis Fang struck again and a third time. One of the scales cracked and flaked away, and the sight of exposed flesh renewed Wulfgar's hopes of victory. Isengdeath had lived through many battles, though, and was far from finished. The dragon knew how vulnerable it was to the powerful hammer and kept its concentration focused enough to retaliate. The long tail circled over the scaly back and cracked into Wulfgar just as the barbarian had begun another swing. Instead of the satisfaction of feeling Aegis Fang crushing through dragon flesh, Wulfgar found himself slammed against a frozen mound of gold coins 20 feet away. The cavern spun all about him, his watering eyes heightening the starred reflections of light and his consciousness slipping away. But he saw Drizzt, scimitars drawn, advancing boldly toward Isengdeath. He saw the dragon poised to breathe again. He saw, with crystalline clarity, the immense icicle hanging from the ceiling above the dragon. Drizzt walked forward. He had no strategy against such a formidable foe. He hoped that he would spot some weakness before the dragon killed him. He thought that Wulfgar was out of the battle and probably dead after the mighty slash of the tail, and was surprised when he saw sudden movement off to the side. Isengdeath sensed the barbarian's move as well, and sent its long tail to squelch any further threat to its flank. But Wulfgar had already played his hand. With the last burst of strength he could muster, he snapped up from the mound and launched Aegis Fang high into the air. The dragon's tail struck home, and Wulfgar didn't know if his desperate attempt was successful. He thought that he saw a lighter spot appear on the ceiling before he was thrown into blackness. Drizzt bore witness to their victory. Mesmerized, the drow watched the silent descent of the huge icicle. Isengdeath, blinded to the danger by the globe of darkness and thinking that the hammer had flown wildly, waved its wings. The clawed forelegs had just begun to lift up when the ice spear smashed into the dragon's back, driving it back to the floor. With a ball of darkness planted on its head, Drizzt couldn't see the dragon's dying expression. But he heard the killing crack as the whip-like neck, launched by the sudden reversal of momentum, rolled upward and snapped.
22. By blood or by deed. The heat of a small fire brought Wulfgar back to consciousness. He came to his senses groggily, and at first could not comprehend his surroundings as he wriggled out of a blanket that he did not remember bringing. Then he recognized Isengdeath, lying dead just a few yards away, the huge icicle rooted firmly in the dragon's back. The globe of darkness had dissipated, and Wulfgar gawked at how accurate the drow's approximated bow shots had been. One arrow protruded from the dragon's left eye, and the black shafts of two others stuck out from the mouth. Wulfgar reached down to grasp the security of Aegis Fang's familiar handle. But the hammer was nowhere near him. Fighting the pervading numbness in his legs, the barbarian managed to stand up, searching around frantically for his weapon. And where, he wondered, was the drow? Then he heard the tapping coming from a side chamber. Stiff-legged, he moved cautiously around a bend. There was Drizzt, standing atop a hill of coins, breaking away its icy covering with Wulfgar's warhammer. Drizzt noticed Wulfgar approaching and bowed low in greeting.
"Well met, Dragonsbane," he called. "And to you, friend elf," Wulfgar responded, thoroughly pleased to see the drow again. "You have followed me a long way."
"Not too far," Drizzt replied, chopping another chunk of ice off the treasure. "There was little excitement to be found in Ten Towns, and I could not let you forge ahead in our competition of kills." 10 1/2 to 10 1/2, he declared, smiling broadly, "and a dragon to split between us. I claim half the kill."
"Yours and well earned," Wulfgar agreed. "And claim to half the booty."
Drizzt revealed a small pouch hanging on a fine silver chain around his neck.
"A few baubles," he explained. "I need no riches, and doubt that I would be able to carry much out of here anyway. A few baubles will suffice."
He sifted through the portion of the pile he had just freed from the ice, uncovering a gem-encrusted sword pommel, its black adamantite hilt masterfully sculpted into the likeness of the toothed maw of a hunting cat. The lure of the intricate workmanship pulled at Drizzt, and with trembling fingers he slid the rest of the weapon out from under the gold. A scimitar. Its curving blade was of silver and diamond-edged. Drizzt raised it before him, marveling at its lightness and perfect balance.
"A few baubles. And this," he corrected.
Even before he had encountered the dragon, Wulfgar wondered how he would escape the underground caverns.
The current of the water is too strong, and the ledge of the water drop too high to go back through Evermelt," he said to Drizzt, though he knew that the drow would have surmised the same thing.
"Even if we somehow find our way through those barriers, I have no more deer blubber to protect us from the cold when we leave the water.
I also have no mind to pass through the waters of Evermelt again," Drizzt assured the barbarian. "Yet I rely on my considerable experience to bring me into such situations prepared. Thus the wood for the fire and the blanket that I put upon you, both wrapped in sealskin. And also this." He produced a three-pronged grapple and some light but strong cord from his belt. He had already discovered an escape route. Drizzt pointed up to a small hole in the roof above them. The icicle that had been dislodged by Aegis Fang had taken part of the chamber's ceiling with it.
"I cannot hope to throw the hook so high, but your mighty arms should find the toss a minor challenge."
"In better times, perhaps," replied Wulfgar. "But I have no strength to make the attempt."
The barbarian had come closer to death than he realized when the dragon's breath had descended upon him, and with the adrenaline of the fight now used up, he felt the pervading cold keenly.
"I fear that my unfeeling hands could not even close upon the hook."
"Then run," yelled the drow. "Let your chilled body warm itself."
Wulfgar was off at once, jogging around the wide chamber, forcing his blood to circulate through his numbed legs and fingers. In a short while, he began to feel the inner warmth of his own body returning. It took him only two throws to put the grapple through the hole and get it to catch fast on some ice. Drizzt was the first to go, the agile elf veritably running up the cord. Wulfgar finished his business in the cavern, collecting a bag of riches and some other items he knew he would need. He had much more difficulty than Drizzt in ascending the cord, but with the drow's assistance from above, he managed to scramble onto the ice before the westering sun dipped below the horizon. They camped beside Evermelt, feasting on venison and enjoying a much-needed and well-deserved rest in the comfort of the warming vapors. Then they were off again before dawn, running west. They ran side by side for 2 days, matching the frenzied pace that had brought them so far east. When they came upon the trails of the gathering barbarian tribes, both of them knew that the time had come for them to part.
"Farewell, good friend," said Wulfgar as he bent low to inspect the trails. "I shall never forget what you have done for me."
"And to you, Wulfgar," Drizzt replied somberly. "May your mighty warhammer terrorize your enemies for years to come."
He sped off, not looking back, but wondering if he would ever see his large companion alive again. Wulfgar put aside the urgency of his mission to pause and ponder his emotions when he first viewed the large encampment of the assembled tribes. 5 years before, proudly carrying the standard of the tribe of the Elk, the younger Wulfgar had marched to a similar gathering, singing the Song of Tempest and sharing strong mead.